Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. No more sleeps. It's finally here. Team Wonky Review, the review of post-18 education and funding. It's all coming up.
I mean, the immediate response from universities is will be focused on sort of financial penalty of Augur and about the impact on teaching, learning and research. And the Augur review is quite clear that the panel has kind of accepted the latest report of the OFS on the financial health of the sector.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education, policy, people and politics. I'm Rachel Firth and I come with the news that finally the review of post-18 education and funding has been published. Weighing in at 216 pages, the Augur review, as it's known by its friends, has landed. And if you haven't carved out the time to read it as yet, don't you worry, we have. And in this episode, we're going to take you through the highlights, the talking points and the key policy recommendations. As this is a special episode, our three guests this week are all from Team Wonky, forming the Destiny's Child of HE policy, if you will. So around the Wonky campfire, we have editor Debbie McVitie. Debbie, what was your favourite page of the review?
Well, I know that there will be lots in the review that people want to question and challenge and debate, but I think we can probably all agree that the page that set out the purposes of the post-compulsory education sector and rolled in both further and higher education into that, and talking about the civic mission, the mission to research and innovate and produce scholarship and to help people achieve their ambitions is a really great aspect of the review.
We also have Associate Editor David Kernahan, or DK as we call him. DK, what was your favourite page in the review?
I would have to say page 74, figure 3.7. It is nice to see subject facts and track T getting some attention at last. It's one of those tables that you initially look at and think, wow, this is really good information. But then when you dig into it and you recall that the definitions of the subject groupings for facts were changed in 2012, and the data is actually from 2016-17, and that all of the subjects are in fact mainly sorted by their old hefty price group, it doesn't actually really tell you anything.
And finally, we have Wonky's founder and editor-in-chief, Mark Leach. Mark, what was your favourite page of the review?
Hi, Rachel. Well, last night I had a surreal encounter with an official, a very senior official from the Department for Education, who called me about 5 minutes after sending the Augur report to get my view and ask, I guess, what the sort of tone of our coverage will be, and is there any questions that we had. But as it's been mentioned, this mammoth document was just coming up on our screens, 216 pages, loads and loads of data. And I was still reading it. I think I was still on the introduction section when asked about it. So I didn't have a lot of detailed questions. And so she asked me what I thought of the front cover and the design. And the fonts and the layout, which, as readers of Wonky may have picked up, is something that I do actually have a lot of views about and commented on in the past. But she was obviously feeling that the front cover, I guess, was a bit ugly or Spartan. I'm not quite sure what. But I compared it favourably to previous government reports. The typesetting, I think, in the overall report is pretty clear and easy to read. But the front cover in particular avoids the problem fallen and the trap fallen into by similar things like the white paper with a stock image that can end up having kind of weird a weird origin that doesn't really make sense. So the white paper a while back now had this student that when you reverse the image search was from some kind of Canadian college. It was kind of hard to understand why that was on the cover. So having avoided that kind of pitfall, I'd said, well, you know, it's fairly smart. It does what it does, you know, does what it says, and doesn't get you into any political hot water. So congratulations.
Which hopefully may be true of the whole rest of the review.
So around about 600 years ago, in February 2018, Mrs. May took to the floor at Derby College to announce a review into post-18 education funding. Expected report in the autumn last year, the report has very much been the victim of turbulent political times being pushed back until convenient to release. In the interim, we've had leak after leak after leak about the contents of the report, but now it has finally landed. Mark, was this what we expected?
Well, I think yes and no is the short answer. The long answer, let's get into. A couple of things to say. It's the report is an advisory panel report, as you say, commissioned by Theresa May for a government review on post-18 education. And the government have confirmed to us over the last couple of days that this review is ongoing. So the review doesn't conclude with the publication of Philip Auger's review. Philip Auger's review is a kind of advisory report to the wider government review, which now carries on and will probably culminate in the spending review. So that's, I just wanted to frame what we say around that. This is a kind of moving target for the next several months, at least. In terms of the content, it was widely expected that a cut to tuition fees would be recommended, and it does, the 7.5K. It rebalances that, or recommends the government should rebalance that with teaching grant, targeted particularly at subjects with good graduate outcomes and that have of high quality and other things. So it also recommends the freeze of tuition fees remain. So it does represent over 5 years under its own analysis about 11% cuts to universities, or they would describe that as an efficiency, which is obviously problematic for universities, but not pushing over the cliff edge kind of level. And I think most universities have kind of largely modelled for that. It situates universities very much as part of a post-18 education tertiary system, with FE and HE serving different functions, but coming together at key points. And for me, it's one of the most interesting aspects in the previous government reviews that have touched on HE have been just so focused on things like tuition fees in isolation. And what's great about Auger actually is it really situates the question about how much university should cost to students and the taxpayers in the context of how much our whole education system should cost, both to deliver and for the students that study there and graduates that pay back. It's that kind of holistic view that I think makes this report so much more robust than its predecessors, and also so much more interesting, because the way those different sectors link together are very complicated and multifaceted, lead us to all sorts of interesting questions about how we spend our resource in an age where we don't have an unlimited kind of money tree. And there's some, as a result of that, some very uncomfortable questions for universities, which are by far the most expensive part of the post-compulsory education system. And compared particularly to, as it does repeatedly in review against further education colleges, they don't come out very well, because they're spending, as Auger would argue, too much money on subjects that don't need it, that don't have good enough outcomes, where further education colleges are being pushed to the brink. So that's obviously a very big challenge to universities, but I think also makes the overall policy analysis and the recommendations that underpin it so much more powerful. There's a lot more to say about all those different issues, and we'll get into some of them today, and plenty more flowing through the site as we speak.
I wonder if the immediate response from universities is will be focused on sort of financial penalty of Auger and about the impact on teaching, learning, and research. And the Auger review is quite clear that The panel has kind of accepted the latest report of the OFS on the financial health of the sector, which broadly says that the majority of universities are in reasonably good financial health. Of course, that does rather gloss over the handful of universities who are not in great financial health, and also the issues around rising costs of pensions. And I think it's interesting that the panel says, oh, well, there will be universities will be able to recruit more students to address the costs of, to address increasing costs and make up the difference. And I suspect that inside the sector, it will not be, that will not be seen as a kind of legitimate way of making up the difference.
Well, I think we have to remember where this report came from. As Mark hinted at the top, it is an started off as an announceable. It was a thing that could be announced to prove that the government was taking action on something. And the announceable in question was that the Labour offer on fees in the 2017 election was meant to be particularly attractive to young people. But despite this, it seems like they have accidentally done a pretty sensible review of some of the worst problems of the current system and have come up with sensible solutions. I don't think anyone was expecting much from the Augur report. I think it surpassed a lot of people's expectations. I mean, Debbie and Mark have both mentioned the supposed bombshell on subject costs. Of course, tractee and subject facts calculations vary both by institution and by subject. That data is not actually public, but I feel like there's a lot more in this than we've got so far from the review and from all of the stuff that has been released alongside it.
Well, I've just come from the launch of the report this morning, where Theresa May spoke about it. The launch this morning was absolutely bedlam, partly because I think they could have kept it as a bit of a secret that Theresa May was kind of pop along. We knew that Philip Borger and Damien Hines were going to speak. Damien Hines was kind of oddly breezy and light, sort of introducing the whole thing, but without really saying anything. But it was absolutely bedlam because it's a hot day here in London, and this was a meeting room of Policy Exchange, the think tank in Westminster, and they'd invited pretty much the entire sector, along with the national media, not only kind of print journalists, but also camera crews and sound and all kinds of things, crammed into, as I say, the Policy Exchange meeting room, which for kind of aficionados of meeting rooms in Westminster is kind of a classic of the genre in its kind of pokiness, general air conditioning or lack of, and suspended ceilings. So you've got basically more than half the people standing up around the back and the sides. Oh, also about 200 officials from DfE, it looked like to me, all in suits. some of which worked on Augur, some of which were kind of part of all the different ministers' entourage, because Chris Skidmore was also there. And of course, then you had panel members, Edward Peck and Alison Wolfe in the front row. But yeah, it was bedlam. And what was kind of funny to me was the Policy Exchange toilets are kind of just off the open plan office, and you've got to kind of walk through the sort of the stage, stage in the meeting room, and into the kind of the Policy Exchange open plan office area to kind of get to the toilets. And that really, between the meeting room, the open plan office area, and the toilets, it's kind of really the only space there is at Policy Exchange in Westminster, as you'd probably kind of imagine for a think tank. Well, it was quite a funny moment where I kind of arrived about 20 minutes early, noticed that obviously the place is heaving already, pop off to the facilities to find Damien Hines and Philip Augur deep in conversation, because the only place available to them is literally outside the loo. And then I walked back into my seat. I obviously didn't listen to what they were saying, and they kind of looked away sharply as I walked past. I walked back to my seat as the event starts to kick off, and there, some officials are kind of hushing around and moving some things, and there's a kind of a general hush emerges, and David Goodhart's there, and all sorts of grand people, and then Theresa May walked out of the door I'd just come through, And I'd just been in this other part of the office where there is some desks. Honestly, there are some desks that belong to, I guess, you know, people that work for Policy Exchange, and the kitchen area, kitchenette area, and the loos. And I'm like, was Theresa May hiding in the loo? I think she was hiding in the fridge, or she was hiding in the loo for like dramatic effect. Because surprise! I have no idea where she came from. Because I. Yeah, it was a very odd moment for anyone in the room, particularly as we didn't expect Theresa May to be at this event. So it was like a kind of double magic trick. Like, not only is Theresa May here, but she's been hiding all along. I wonder if kind of the number 10 kind of like advanced team have these kind of special ways of sweeping them in and out of the building so that you don't know, you can't kind of see them come and go. Or there's a secret tunnel from Policy Exchange to number 10 that is obviously not visible to mere mortals like me. But whatever the explanation, it was surreal. And it was clear that she was situating this as part of her dealing with the kind of the burning injustices. She mentioned again, that's her line, the burning injustices in society that she wants to deal with. But, you know, by I think most objective measures really hasn't, because she's only been focused on Brexit. And she was asked whether this kind of ties the hands of future leader of the Tory party, which question she kind of ducked. I don't think it does, because they can take or leave it. It's certainly an absolutely critical pillar of the spending review negotiations that the Department for Education will be taking forward. And now it will matter greatly who the Secretary of State and Universities Minister are when a new Tory leader takes over in this July, because they will look at this and probably want to push up or down the various different levers here. They might be slightly more disposed to the big boost to FE funding that is recommended here, and less disposed to the cuts to universities, or vice versa. So it's going to come down to those both the negotiations and also the kind of the political views of our next set of ministers. If Damien Hines and Chris Skidmore stay, I think Hines here being kind of the key person in all this, it's pretty clear where he stands on this, and he's put his colours against the mast quite strongly when it comes to the cost of delivery inside universities. He wants to see the OFS target its teaching grants towards what he calls high quality subjects. The question really being then in that negotiation, how much the Treasury sees this as a appropriate way of driving efficiency in the system, and whether or not it's enough for them to be able to top up the teaching grant with more funds. And again, that's going to come down to who the Chancellor of Exchequer is largely. So some big questions, and a lot depends on the ministerial team that we're going to be getting in July. But this sets hairs running on so many levels. And I think no matter what happens politically in the next 6 months or so, I think there's a huge amount of really interesting ideas packed in the org review for us to take away and debate as a sector. And a lot of it does actually push responsibility to universities to deal with, not just government. For example, it says, well, yes, pension costs are going up, but if you get your house in order so that you can recruit more students when the demographics start booming again, then that should be fine.
There's a kind of there's a wing of the Tory party, and I think sort of represented by Joe Johnson and Sam Jima, and who have the sort of legitimate criticism that a headline cut to the fees is basically kind of damaging the university sector, but they are using that position, you know, on the sort of full political knowledge that it will be very challenging for the sector to make the case on an ongoing basis, you know, sort of not just from 2021-22, but kind of 10 years in the future, that the difference should be made up from taxpayer funds. But they're using that as a kind of platform to say, oh, well, the Augur review is a waste of time. The Augur review is not something that we should pay attention to. And they're sort of trying to kind of sweep it under the carpet with a view to, you know, the next leader of the party and prime minister kind of sort of just moving on and burying it as part of Theresa May's kind of slightly tarnished legacy. And I think that would be really sad, actually, for some of the same reasons that Mark's talked about, particularly because it's the real consensus built around the necessity of boosting and developing and repositioning further education as part of a post-compulsory sector that meets the needs of everybody. And I think one of the kind of most killer kind of points that the report makes is that although the number of and proportion of university students has been going pretty steadily upwards, the overall numbers of people in the general population studying at post 18 has been going downwards since 2010, and that's something that any leader is going to have to address in the future.
I just wanted to mention the responses from the two previous universities ministers, which I think are interesting and instructive. So Joe Johnston has said, looks like AUGA, as predicted, will destabilise uni finances, imperil many courses, and reverse projects from widening access. Reducing fees to 7.5k will leave a funding hole, which the Treasury won't fill, and benefit only the highest earning graduates at the expense of the general taxpayer. Bad policy, bad politics. In normal times, that would be a bit of a shocker coming from a prominent backbencher, but this is 2019, so we let that one pass. Sam Gima has said, there's a big debate to be had on HE, which is precisely why a headline-grabbing approach to reform is wrong-headed. There is precedent for a new administration to publish a review commissioned by a previous one. Authority to build consensus is key. So amongst those in government that it could fairly be said know the sector, there's not a lot of love for this review, which I think in terms of implementing what it says is going to make things very difficult for a government already struggling to pass any kind of legislation.
Mark, you were at the review. You probably have more thoughts on this. How was that?
I was chatting to a number of different panel members, and just adding to DK's point. I mean, consensus is going to be very difficult to be built. But what I think this report has done is made it impossible to dismiss it out of hand. So there's a lot to criticise. There's a lot of challenge. But what I think is kind of the triumph of policymaking here is that it's so serious and detailed and comprehensive that all those people that want it to be dead on arrival, dismiss it as Theresa May's education funding policy review or whatever, are basically out of luck, because it's basically too high quality piece of work. And I was chatting to different members of the AUGA panel this morning, and they kind of backed up that was a huge part of that was basically intentional, because given the political volatility at the moment, they knew there's a huge risk about what's going to happen to it. So the best they could do was put out something that was, you know, really, really high quality, that made it very, very difficult and awkward for literally anyone to say, well, this is nonsense, it can't be done, you know, just basically dismiss it. So it won't be dismissed. Whether or not we'll manage to build a true consensus around it remains to be seen. And I think that the sector reaction that builds over the next few months is going to be really, really important to watch, because in the spirit of the review, if it's simply, you know, sector versus pitted against sector, you know, that will be that. I don't think that will find much favour in Whitehall. What the review captures is a sense that different parts of the post-compulsory education system need to work together much more closely. And I think it would be a mistake, whether you're sitting in universities or in FE or in some other part of it, to say, no, I'm just going to try and protect my little slice of the pie. Because what I think AUGA does is point to an era where that's no longer politically fashionable.
Next up, one of the new policy ideas in the document focuses on getting more students to study higher technical qualifications and proposes a lifelong learning loan allowance to be used at higher technical and degree level at any stage of an adult's career for full and part-time students. So, Debbie, what did you make of this recommendation?
Well, what I find really interesting about the basis, I mean, there's so much in the report about growth in level 4 and 5 and some of the stuff that we were expecting, but the premise on which a lot of this analysis and recommendations is based is that the market doesn't work in higher education or indeed for further education. And one of the kind of core principles of the review is that the market acting alone cannot be trusted to deliver policy outcomes. And if you think that, I mean, there are some who would say that the marketization of higher education has been going on for kind of, you know, two decades, but, you know, it really took off, I think, with the coalition and the 2011 white paper and the kind of David Willetts agenda to, you know, have student choice driving quality in the system. And I mean, this is really, you know, if if this premise is accepted, you've got sort of a mere decade of kind of radical marketization before you've got the sort of 180 degree turn to say, well, actually, this is a problem and there is a role for government. So some of the things that the panel believes that the market has delivered or failed to deliver, one is skill shortages, that there are kind of skill areas in the economy that are where needs are not being met. So we're not kind of, students may be choosing, but they're not choosing the sorts of qualifications that are actually going to address economic need. Another is that the panel accepts the idea that there's too many graduates at level six and above. So and kind of accepts the, I think, quite contested evidence around what's often referred to as over-education, that people are too skilled for the sorts of jobs they're doing. And I think, I mean, that evidence, you know, can always be added to, but that's sort of where the premise is. And something that we referred to earlier, which is that, you know, the overall decline in post-18 education. So people who sort of stop at level three or who never even quite make it to level three and then therefore have no kind of obvious access to higher level skills at all. The other kind of impact, which is that courses that cost less to deliver tend to proliferate, whether or not they are of value to the economy. And this, of course, is really, really contentious because, you know, so basically the review goes almost so far as to say, well, yes, we have business courses in business, social studies, creative arts. Yes, we need some of those sorts of courses, but we don't think that we need as many as are currently being taken up. And we think that we need more courses in physical sciences, engineering, sort of STEM, high value subjects. And I say all this sort of heavily caveated because this is a really, really strong value judgment. And although there's some evidence around, you know, it's based on evidence and it's based on the views of stakeholders, it's going to be incredibly contentious. But the recommendations are focused on developing a much more flexible and accessible way into higher level skills, focused on the accumulation of credit at level four and five, which could then obviously be then kind of taken forward to level six if that was appropriate, but wouldn't need to be. So there's kind of a few elements of this. One is that this lifelong learning loan allowance would students would be able to you know, do a year of study, get a level four. They would even be able to do a module, and you know, as part of CPD, and they wouldn't be obliged to sign up for a full 3-year course at level six in order to take on these sorts of things. And there would be an expectation. It's not clear to me exactly how this would be implemented, but there would be an expectation that for students that were studying to pursue anything above level four, that they would still be issued with a certificate or some kind of recognition of their trajectory at level four and five. And for those who aren't familiar in depth with the framework for higher education qualifications, level four is equivalent to about 1 year of higher education and level five to 2 years. And all of this, I mean, the other point that's made is that currently there's different kinds of level four and five qualifications. So there's HE certs, there's HNDs, higher education diplomas, foundation degrees, and then there's a whole bunch of other sorts of things that aren't that are sort of less more commonly delivered in further education colleges that tend to be validated by bodies like City and Guilds, and they're sort of different again. And the proposal is that the Office for Students should have oversight of all level four and five, all higher level qualifications, and that they there should be some kind of reconciling or kite marking of the ones that are of high value, so that it's easier to navigate. And this would really go quite a long way to addressing some issues around credit transferability, access to higher education for part-time and mature students. It would be really quite transformative potentially if it can be made to work.
I think a lot of the recommendations have the underlying idea that we are going to get back to looking at qualifications and study that has value to the wider economy as determined by the government via some kind of industrial strategy. So, I mean, whereas attention paid to ideas of retraining and upskilling is long overdue, I think it remains to be seen what kind of retraining and upskilling is going to be explicitly supported by the government, and what other kinds of retraining and upskilling will sit outside of that. So it does feel like there's we've got half of the answer and we're kind of waiting for the other half.
This is the kind of stuff that's always really challenging to universities, because it not only situates them as part of the kind of the wider tertiary landscape, but it directly puts them alongside different types of providers. And the Augur review kind of talks about kind of on-ramps and off-ramps and the way that you might, for example, if you don't complete a full-time undergraduate degree, you might be able to leave with a level 4 qualification, perhaps, that the university could award even. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that really starts to kind of chop up the landscape, but in a way that will lead potentially to lots of really, really great outcomes if it can be made to work, as Debbie says. But it also goes far beyond government policymaking. It would take a huge sea change in universities' approach to working as part of that tertiary landscape with other kinds of providers, kind of encroaching on their turf in traditional ways, but might actually deliver some more interesting kinds of opportunities for students.
Next up, we talk about student finance. But before we get into that, I want to tell you about the Wonky Daily, our daily email briefing to keep you up to date with everything that's going on in higher education. It's delivered to your inbox at 8 a.m. every day, and you'll get all the essential information and analysis that you need in one place, helping you navigate all the twists and turns going on in higher education policy. And of all weeks in higher education policy, this is the one you need to keep bang up to date with, understand the implications of the post-18 funding review, what it means for you and what it means for your institution. You can sign up for a 30-day free trial of our briefing service. Just email us on briefing@wonky.com. That's briefing@wonky.com. Or you can visit the website wonky.com/plus. Right, next up, we're looking at what the review panel has to say about student finance, including fee loans and maintenance for students' living costs. DK, would you mind giving us an overview of this one, please?
Absolutely. So this contained, I think, the biggest genuine surprise of the whole review, which is a recommendation that would affect existing students and existing graduates that are repaying their loan. The review recommends that your contributions, repayments, as it were, your lifetime repayments are capped at 1.2 times the initial loan amount in real terms. So the review is recommending this will happen for everybody, and this will be, broadly speaking, a progressive measure. It will affect graduates who earn less over their career, so are more likely to be repaying for longer. This sounds like bad news, but for future students and future graduates, there's also some bad news to go alongside it. The length of repayment is extended from 30 to 40 years, meaning, as was on the front page of several papers this morning, that graduates could be paying back their student loans well into their 60s. And the repayment threshold is going down in real terms. So there is a reduction. If it happened now, it would go down from 25k as it currently sits to 23k, which is round about the average income of a non-graduate of a similar age range as graduates. So that's actually not going to happen until 2021-22. That will take the form of a freeze. So the repayment threshold will sit at the same level until then, by which point it will be worth the same as what 23k is now. So this might sound like a little bit of a bad deal. There's a little bit of an extra silver lining in that the real in-study interest, so the fact that you're paying interest at the highest available rate while you are studying, interest is accruing on your loan, that will go. The loan balances will track inflation only. They will not include the commercial range of interest. So this is in terms of fee loans particularly, but also the overwhelming majority of graduates will also have maintenance loans, and we're interested to hear what happens to them. So the recommendation is to restore grants to at least £3,000 a year for socioeconomically disadvantaged students. The recommendation is there that they do some more work on what a socioeconomically disadvantaged student actually is. It's not going to be linked to POLA or just to parental income. It will be a range of measures, a basket of measures, if you will. They're doing some little bits and pieces about the maximum maintenance support. This is going to be set in line with the national minimum wage. They actually use that terminology rather than the national living wage, which is interesting for people who follow such things. So that's the national minimum wage of age 21 to 24 on the basis of 37.5 hours a week and 30 weeks a year. So that is that suggests that the maintenance on offer will be equivalent to the absolute minimum that the government thinks a person can survive on during that time. That is a slight cut, I think, from where it is currently, which is something that obviously is not made much of in the review itself. So why have they come up with all this? Well, they did a couple of surveys. One survey of current students, prospective students, and graduates, and one survey of the general public and the parents of prospective students. And these two surveys, which have just been published alongside the report, along with a bunch of other stuff, have had a huge impact on the way these recommendations have been set up. One of the general public in particular has got quite a small value for N, a little over 1,000, and included only 131 parents of prospective student, which strikes me as a little bit low.
Indeed. Mark, what did you make of all? What do you make of this?
I think it's
element of the report.
It's an interesting package. But it's kind of good, as DK eloquently describes. I think it's kind of good in some ways and bad in other ways. But also, it's still really complicated. And there's a suggestion that they could rebrand the scheme, call it kind of graduate contribution scheme or something like that. But we're still talking about the same levers moving up and down, which lead to the same kinds of misunderstandings about how the system work. And this is just kind of moving the dials around again, in, as I say, ways that are good and bad. There are still lots of unknowns there about some of these. And I think a lot will come to light over the coming days. But for example, on maintenance grants, it's not exactly clear. As DK says, they don't know which measures should be used to account for the means test, and it needs further study. But the overall cost of the reform looks kind of worryingly small. So it looks like they're thinking that these would return for only the very most disadvantaged students, which of course most people would welcome, in that they're the people that need most help. But could well be a far cry from the 41% or so that got the full maintenance grant when it was abolished a number of years ago. So that's going to be a really interesting debate, and kind of speak to probably again the question of what ministerial priority will be. You know, do we target our resources on a small number of disadvantaged students, or do we try and make a sweeping change and give maintenance grants to as many people as possible? As I say, more detail about that will emerge over the coming days. One final point is that on back to my point about kind of the complexity, is that what I don't think this package does is provide a very neat kind of retail offer. In a way that I think the closest cousin to it in government reviews, I think, would be the Diamond Review of the Welsh HE funding system, which was out last year, being implemented now, and that provided a really neat package that students could understand, very very clear, completely switched around the system, and provided a high level of support. The numbers were bold and understandable. And there was no ambiguity, and there wasn't this kind of creeping sense that, well, we might, you know, keep moving these dials up and down, which I think, as long as we've got this current system, looks eminently possible, depending on the overall cost of the system and ministerial priority and other things. So I think that, as I say, good in some ways, bad in other ways, but we're left with, I think, the one of the most fundamental problems with the current system, in that still no one's going to understand it, and the government could well keep changing it.
I think what's kind of important to recognise about this is that it's the panel has obviously looked at the ruling of the Office of National Statistics about the way that student loans are treated in the national accounts, and the fact that the taxpayer now has a much more visible stake, you know, that the taxpayer subsidy is now recognised up front rather than at the back end. You know, that's so actually one of the intentions of this, and I think there's going to be this huge tension between the urge to provide a retail offer to students to kind of capture back the youth vote, not necessarily to out Corbyn, but to at least kind of send a message that you know the Conservative Party and a future Conservative government wants to support your aspirations, and the wider kind of taxpayer sense of we actually. Some of this DfE research said, "Well, yes, we would actually like students to pay more back in the round because we think that's fair and reasonable." So, I think the politics of this will get pretty crunchy pretty quickly. And if anything sticks around, I can imagine that the reintroduction of maintenance grants. I mean, nobody can disagree with that. Everyone thinks it's a marvelous idea. But some of the stuff around repayments and thresholds and stuff is going to kind of roll and roll and probably end up as a fudge. And of course, it's no one knows exactly what the system will cost, because a methodology for calculating it doesn't exist yet. So it could all unravel pretty quickly.
Accommodation costs that we've long been seeing a trend of critiques of the sector which say that the costs of actually a student living and particularly in renting accommodation have risen and risen, and the amount of money available to students has not risen to meet this. A long time ago, I asked Sam Gima if he felt that maybe we should start actually gathering data on accommodation costs at a national level so we could start to understand where the problems were. And he told me, no, it's not really a problem for central government. So it is nice to see that one of the recommendations of the Auger review is that the OFS should examine the cost of student accommodation more closely and work with student providers to improve the quality and consistency of data about costs, rents, profits, and accommodation quality. So that's certainly a fun thing to look forward to for us all.
One of the ones that jumped out for me was the proposal for a minimum entry requirement. So it had been leaked in the press of the kind of idea that you need 3 Ds to enter university. Now, then a couple of days ago was briefed heavily that this wasn't in the review, but then sort of half is and half isn't. So what it does is it says that there's kind of a lot of merit in that idea, but the government should intervene to do it, basically if the sector doesn't get its house in order on admissions. So it's sort of not explicitly proposed, but doesn't kill off the issue by any means, and is likely to kind of run. What we also probably can't see is the actual cost of the proposals. So there's lots of new methodology pending for the accounting of student loans. Lots of decisions to be made about the measures we use to do things like give maintenance grants. And although we've got some high level numbers, it's going to take a bit of time and a bit of imagination to fully cost it all up. And the review itself makes that point towards the end. Obviously, we're going to do our best to make decent judgments about it on the site and in our analysis, but harder numbers will emerge, I guess, in due course, particularly around the spending review, which I mentioned. And I think the big one, which was the sort of the kickoff Damien Hines trail of Auger when it was announced in February 2018, made it sound like tuition fees were definitely going to kind of vary and bring back that kind of variability in a way that didn't happen after they raised fees to £9,000 and kind of create a bigger market. Auger basically says that the free market doesn't work for universities, and there are reasons to lower fees. But this kind of variable idea remains the fantasy of politicians, and Auger doesn't really give the ammunition to Damien Hines or another Secretary of State to do that. So I think that's super interesting.
Well, again, there's this, you know, there's a basis for, and this is what I really like about this review, is that you might not agree with everything that's recommended, but at least it's grounded in a principle or a piece of evidence or something. And one of the things that the review says is that students shouldn't pay more. So you know, all students should basically pay the same, because otherwise you get all kinds of sort of silly outcomes with the market, because you have people not choosing more expensive courses because they cost more. So if you start with the premise that students should be basically pay the same, and that no student should pay more than what their course reasonably costs to deliver, which the panel pegs at $7,500, again, you know, contentious, but that's the argument, then that becomes the fee threshold. Everyone gets charged the same, and courses that cost more to deliver get topped up. You know, it's elegant, it makes sense, it's based on a principle. Again, whether that's what actually happens in reality and whether the politics kind of comes in to disrupt the elegant policy solution is the thing that will be, I think, hotly debated in the weeks to come.
The rumours of an entry qualification threshold for universities, they were swirling all the way through the Augur build-up, and we did do a couple of bits of analysis on the site, which you can look at. The review actually commissioned UCAS to look into this. As we said previously, there is a correlation between lower levels of level 3 attainment and students from disadvantaged backgrounds. That's the UCAS multiple equality measure. Broadly, the recommendation is that it's not something they want to put in place at this point, because it would be an example, as they say, an example of social engineering and a breach of the concept of fairness. That does not fit comfortably within a meritocratic education system, which is pretty strong language. But still, they come back to the idea of target number caps on courses offering poor value for money, which I guess in terms of retention, in terms of graduate earnings, both immediately and longer term. And they call for the sector to reform the student recruitment practices. So they reserve the right for the government by 2022-23 to intervene in terms of a contextualized minimum entry threshold, a selective numbers cap, or a combination of both. So even though they've not put the cap on yet, they reserve the right to either do a numbers cap or to have a minimum entry threshold for HE, which is something where I expect to see a lot of lobbying activity to take place.
I think that what Augur does is start a huge conversation about the post-18 education landscape and universities' role in it. I think that it will be thought of as a hugely seminal piece of work in that context. My prediction is that a number of the recommendations will get adopted as government policy and implemented in some way over the next few years, particularly the things around fees, funding, maintenance, and FE. It does obviously depend a lot on how the political situation emerges. But even if LOTS isn't immediately implemented, I think we're in for... I think Augur reframes the debate in such a way that should lead us to a much more rounded and holistic conversation about what universities do and how they do it. And I welcome.
We should remember, though, that no independent review commissioned by government has ever actually been implemented. So Deering recommended one thing and Labour implemented another, likewise with Brown. So, if you're putting money on it, I would certainly not put money on the Augur review being implemented as proposed. Because that's just not how it works.
Labour implemented a lot of Deering, though, and I think future government will implement lots of Augur. It's clearly not going to be taken kind of completely in the round, but I'd be amazed if different bits of it don't end up in policy over the next couple of years.
But that's actually the advantage of this review. I mean, every other review that we have mentioned, I mean, Brown, Deering, even back to Robbins, it was set out as a complete set of recommendations that have to be implemented together. I mean, we've seen this more recently in Wales with Diamond. And this review doesn't say that. It's kind of a pick-and-mix review, that there are a number of clear problems with the current system. This review sets up a number of ways to address them, but it doesn't say you have to do all of them to make it make sense overall. I think it will be seen longer term as a sensible review and as one that tidied up a lot of problems with the Higher Education and Research Act that we pointed out at the time. But it will not be seen as a visionary review. It will not be seen as something that makes a lasting radical long-term change to the sector. And I think that's fair enough, because to paraphrase Wisnail and I, we've kind of reviewed the post-18 system by accident. It was never really planned as a proper overarching review. I think that what we've got is great, but it was never really meant to hang together as a single set of proposals. I think he has, and in quite a wonderful fashion. I think he's given us a lot to chew over, a lot to talk about. But if you think back to this being a fig leaf for Theresa May and the Conservative government to prove that they were doing something about all those students and young graduates that have voted for Corbyn. It's done a lot more than that.
We've just had news that Theresa May has made her way to the Oval to watch the cricket directly after the Ogre review. So on that bombshell, that is about it for this week. To delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find the links in the show notes. And don't forget, you can subscribe to this podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. If you fancy appearing on a guest of The Wonky... If you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we will be in touch. So thanks to Debbie, to DK and to Mark and everyone at Team Wonky for making this and the reams of Ogre analysis that's happening. Keep an eye on the site in the days and weeks to come, because we're just getting started. And until next week, stay in review.